that was The Time Is Now from the Cora Jazz Trio Part 1. That's a really great album. There's two albums in it. They're really great. And you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we have a very, I think, an extremely important show, and it's one that I think is actually, you know, it's going to have two guests, really. And at the back end of the show, I want everybody to make sure that you know, stick around to hear this, because it's going to feature an interview I did the other day with Sharon Mosby, a black woman whose son, Ronald Boone Jr., was shot by the LAPD on January 28, 2008, and died the morning of January 29, 2008. And Sharon's story is a total, complete, and utter outrage. And I defy anyone to think that there is something worth saving, or that there is some reason why this kind of society that would do something like this should continue to stand. And before that, and actually just as powerful in its indictment of what's going on in this society, is the situation that's arisen. I guess it's began in Atlanta and it's spread all around the country. The idea that somehow abortions and black women, African-American women getting abortions, that somehow abortion providers and abortion clinics servicing large numbers of black women actually is being defined as a genocidal conspiracy. And joining us to talk about this is Jody Jacobson. Jody was last on the show to talk with us about the attack on abortion rights concentrated up in the Stupak-Pitts Amendment to the health care bill being debated out in Congress. And today we're going to talk about what's happened. And I'll tell you, to begin with, a billboard appeared in Atlanta, and there was a number of these billboards. They were financed by the Georgia Right to Life Committee. And the billboard said, "Black children are an endangered species." These billboards are part of an anti-abortion campaign targeting black women. And from that, all kinds of hell is broken loose. So let's welcome Jody to the show. Jody Jacobson from... Hi.
How are you?
Good. And I should tell people you're from the rhrealitycheck.org, one of my favorite websites in the world. And
Thank you.
Sure. And I'm really looking forward to talking with you about this today.
I'm sorry I didn't hear much of your intro, but I know what we're talking about. So just if there's anything I should refer to, tell me.
Basically, what I'd like to start with is, I talked about the billboard that appeared in Atlanta that black children are an endangered species, and how that was hooked into this idea that somehow the high abortion rate among black women somehow indicates a genocidal conspiracy against black people in general. And I wanted you to give people a sense, because there was a lot more that went on just besides that billboard. It was almost like an army of these Christian fascists came into motion around this. And could you give people just a sense of the breadth and the scope of what's been going on around this?
First, I think even to step back one step further is to make clear that this is but one sort of salvo in a multifaceted campaign to reduce women's access to contraception, sex education, abortion. It's not just about abortion, and it's part of a multi-front battle that is going on. And this is just one strategy that the anti-choice side is using. They have now 20 billboards up in Atlanta. And the billboards are, as you say, charging reproductive health providers with effectively coercing women into having abortions for the purpose of racial genocide. And it's absurd on its face. It is true that African-American women have a high rate of abortion, but the fact of the matter behind that, the cause of that, is a high rate of unintended pregnancy. And the unintended pregnancy is the result of the fact that African-American women have among the least access to contraception and to effective education on how to use contraception. They also have low rates of health insurance coverage, high rates of social and economic isolation, and high rates of violence against women within their communities. And so you put those factors together, and you have a problem of high rates of unintended pregnancy. And because the desired family size of most of the African-American community is roughly 2 children per family, in order to reach that family size, when you have an unintended pregnancy, women turn to abortion. So it has absolutely nothing to do with racial genocide, but it's an easy, of course, and very, very dangerous claim that Georgia Right to Life and other such groups are making.
One of the things that I saw in just doing the research for this segment, that while the abortion rate is very high for black women, and at the same time, there's also the birth rate is also higher than it is for white and other nationalities in the U.S. It seemed to me that if you somehow get stuck into arguing this out on the basis of this really, I mean, really dangerous and actually, we'll get into this a little bit later in terms of where the truth lies in some of this stuff. The whole fact, if you get sucked into this, that even on the face of it, the critical question is not whether or not fewer black people are being born. It's actually more the question of exactly what you're saying. What is the status of black women in society? And what does that say? I mean, it's part of the dehumanization of black people, but what's the status of black women as part of that gender? And what's being done to people about the denial of any kind of healthcare, abortion, preventative healthcare in terms of the contraceptive and everything else, these things are being really denied a huge chunk of people.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because the other day, March 10th, was Women and Girls HIV Awareness Day in the United States. And if you look at the domestic epidemic, and actually I put a challenge out to the so-called pro-life community about this, if you look at the domestic epidemic, African-American women have the highest rate of new infections of HIV, the least access to treatment, and the least access to preventive measures for preventing the transmission of HIV. And so you have this problem that's literally killing African American women at a much higher rate than anyone else in the population who also has an HIV infection because they have less access to treatment. Where are the billboards around that? I mean, and exactly to the point of the things that are, as most of the women in the African-American community who are the leaders in the reproductive justice movement and who are far better positioned to attack this issue than I am, you know, they will tell you, hey, look, first and foremost, we want reproductive and sexual health services in our communities. Secondly, we are quite capable, thank you very much, of making our own decisions. And thirdly, if you're really worried about African-American children, let's talk about violence, lack of access to education, lack of access to nutrition, environmental hazards in our communities. I mean, the list goes on. So again, it's a rather, in many ways, it's such a profound insult to African-American women and people generally to focus on that issue and leave aside the very real issues that exacerbate the conditions that people face who are born people in the African-American community.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Jody Jacobson from RHRealityCheck.org about what's behind this new campaign launched by the Christian fascists to attack abortion rights for black women. One of the things that these right to life people say, and actually let's just call them anti-abortionists, Christian fascists. I just hate this, as if you and I think people don't have a right to life. You know, this
right,
is like,
right.
Come on.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're anti-choice.
Right. And, you know, I would prefer to say they're anti-abortion, because we have to stop being so defensive about abortion. We can talk about this a little bit later, because I think that's really an incredibly important part of this. And you know, one of the things that they say is they talk about the womb is the most dangerous place for a black person in America. You know, there's just so much concentrated that's wrong in that, you know, including the fact there's not many people living in wombs right now.
Exactly. You know? Yes, exactly. But, you know, it makes for easy sound bites. It helps rally ultra-conservative and, as you said, ultra-Christian conservative forces. And certainly because the conservative right has focused very heavily on infiltrating state legislatures and state school boards and, you know, state and community councils and so forth, they are now positioned, as they are doing in Georgia, to pass laws that have nothing to do with reality, and the end result of those laws is merely to make the matter worse, because they end up restricting women's access to the very services that would prevent unintended pregnancy in the first place. So if you were to ask, you know, a right-to-lifer, so-called right-to-lifer, Georgia Right to Life, what's their position on contraception, for example, to make sure that fewer people have unintended pregnancies that lead to abortion, they are against contraceptive access. So they're really, the whole thing is based on a facade, as you point out, of using language to deflect from the real agenda.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jody, one of the things I'd like to ask you is, you know, you think about this, and coming off of even what you just said, you know, this point about, you know, what is provided, what isn't provided, and what's dangerous and what's genocidal and what isn't. You know, there's an aspect of this. You think about one of the things of, Actually, abortion has not been an unpopular thing in the black community. It's not been a thing where, you know, people have been, you know, mainly up in arms against abortion rights. And then it's secondly, that if abortion was taken away, what could have more genocidal implications than what would happen to black women forced to go into back alleys and illegal abortions?
Exactly. Well, you hit the nail on the head. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the caucus, the pro-choice caucus, for example, the Women of Color Pro-Choice Caucus in the Congress wholeheartedly supports women's access to reproductive health care. Just as an example, there are reproductive justice leaders from Loretta Ross at Sister Song in Atlanta to a wide variety of women of color through the Latina, Asian, and other communities of color who are very, very adamant about exactly the points that you're making, that African American women have the right to make their own choices. They have the right to decide whether, when, and with whom to have children. They need, want, and have the right to access to basic preventive care. And if you're really concerned about African American people, then, hey, again, let's focus on those high rates of HIV and let's get preventive care. And, you know, we're talking about targeting. These campaigns target for, you know, effectively target for, dismantlement or dismantling of Planned Parenthood clinics, which are the only places many low-income women have to go for things like pap smears, breast exams, you know, HIV testing, counseling, and on how to prevent sexually transmitted infections. These are the very things that African American women die from at the higher rates than other populations. Breast cancer, cervical cancer, all because they lack access to preventive care. Those are the very types of care that reproductive health clinics provide, and yet those are the clinics that are being targeted for extinction, if you will, by this Right to Life movement. And so it's really ironic when you uncover all the layers of this, and as you again point out, that, you know, what happens? Well, women suffer more.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote an article in response to a New York Times article on this whole situation, and you basically called out the Times for the kind of chicanery and the double talk and the twisting things around that they did in this article, what they left out, and what the, and you know, it's interesting because I was reading your article and then ran across this editorial that the Times did the other day that said, basically tried to come out and say, okay, we were, you know, this is right, there's no conspiracy, and they basically said what you said, that there's no conspiracy except to deny health care, the necessary health care to black women. You know, but the Times, actually, one of the things you pointed out is the Times gave such inordinate amounts of space to all kinds of things. They never really gave people a sense of just who are these people that are behind this campaign. Can you help us out here? Give us a sense of who these people are.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So the Times article that I critiqued basically looked at these two sets of communities, the reproductive justice community, which represents women of color and their activism for their rights, and the, you know, 99% white, so-called pro-life, what I call anti-choice community, that in fact is made up, for example, of people who themselves have voted against additional services for low-income communities, who themselves are against a more affordable health care for low-income communities, who have voted against extending jobless benefits to low-income communities. So you've got leadership in these movements, in Georgia Right to Life, this guy that created this film called MAFA 21, which is, you know, if nothing else, a completely fraudulent view of history of reproductive health care, is also connected to supremacist, white supremacist organizations. So when you, you know, uncover exactly who these folks are, you begin to find out again that the very veneer, the very thin veneer of this so-called campaign of concern. The other thing that I found really appalling about the Times article was the equity of treatment that it gave these two camps. Because if you're talking to people who are in those communities, living in those communities, advocating for those communities, and you give equal weight without asking questions to people who don't live in those communities, who are not of those communities, arguing for something, there's something wrong with that, especially when you don't point out how very little fact these campaigns are based on. The New York Times article, for example, never talked to a public health expert, or if they did, they didn't quote a public health expert talking about the high rate of unintended pregnancies in the African American community the low access to reproductive health care. That might have put this whole thing in perspective. Instead, what it did was it made an equivalency between these anti-choice forces and women of color groups that have been working for years to try to improve access to services.
And another part of the irony in all this is actually that, you know, and the hypocrisy is actually the fact that, you know, a lot of people have pointed out, and a lot of these Christian fascist forces have pointed out that, well, you know, black people, they have a lot of reason to be worried because of the past ties with eugenics and sterilization, forced sterilization, even in places like Puerto Rico, where forced sterilization was just massive at a period of time, not so long ago, actually, in the 60s even. And the Tuskegee experiments regarding syphilis, where black people who contracted syphilis remained untreated. Doctors allowed them to remain untreated. The disease was allowed to develop in these people to its highest and even fatal stages, and they were also allowed to pass it on to partners and children, unbeknownst to them, of course. And it was all part of this fascistic style of so-called scientific investigation that actually amounted to the total dehumanization of black people. You know, you think about all this, and yet they keep advancing that as like, see, here's the proof that there are indeed genocidal conspiracies. And then you think about it, and here are these people that, like Pat Robertson, who claimed Haiti had made a deal with the devil, and that's why they got the earthquake, and that there should be, you know, death penalty for repeat offenders, and, you know, the kind of the idea that God sent down, he basically sent a Hurricane Katrina to smite New Orleans and the black people and gay people for living lasciviously in New Orleans. You know, and this is the kind of program that they actually argue. So it really leaves such a bitter, disgusting taste in your mouth when you read these things.
Mm. Exactly.
I wanted to get into a lot of this stuff about the various forces, but I think people should really check your article out. And you can get it at rhrealitycheck.org. We're talking with Jody Jacobson from rhrealitycheck.org, and we've been talking about the Christian fascist assault on abortion rights for black women. Now, Jody, I want to get into another aspect of things in the time we have remaining. I'd like to talk about the whole campaign that seems to be going on. There's a huge campaign in the last year, even, of all the things that have happened around abortion, where the right to an abortion has been chipped away in state after state after state. And the most recent thing, what has happened, and it's not just abortion, it's anti-women. And the thing that most recently happened in Utah, which I thought was an extremely important, you know, connection with reproductive health, in connection with the lives of women, the denial of the humanity of women, and the criminalization of women. Can you talk about that a little bit? Explain to people what the law is that's been passed and what's the content of it?
Absolutely. I just want to reiterate one thing quickly that you said, which is not only anti-woman, but it's beyond anti-abortion in the sense that even the way that these groups identify a pregnancy is from the moment of fertilization, that a fertilized egg has the same rights as you and I. So therefore, any, you know, contraceptive that they would claim might interfere with the fertilization of an egg or the implantation of a fertilized egg also becomes illegal in their eyes. So I just want to underscore for people that, you know, this is far beyond what you might think of as an abortion. Mm-hmm. But in any case, in Utah, which again, as you noted, is part of a broader campaign, a law was passed last week and then signed by the governor after a slight revision, which effectively makes women who miscarry suspect for murder. In other words, if there are quote-unquote questionable circumstances around a miscarriage, then the police can investigate whether or not you were quote-unquote at fault for that miscarriage and charge you with homicide. And the law is written so vaguely that, as many of these laws are written so vaguely, that what many legal scholars and advocates who are looking at this understand to be the case. Again, when do you define a pregnancy as beginning? Does it begin the minute you're fertilized? Do women then have to be, you know, monitored from the time they're fertilized in case they do something that might... Is a woman who drives in a car and doesn't have her seatbelt on liable to be charged with homicide if something happens? Is a woman who has a beer at dinner? I mean, there are so many ways in which the monitoring of pregnancy comes through in this law, and the scope of application is so broad that it truly is very, very worrisome. It puts women in the place, literally, legally, of being walking incubators. And it's dangerous not just because it's passed in Utah, but it's because this legislator, no doubt in part because he's getting funded by far-right groups and no doubt in part because it gives him a lot of publicity, he's writing what he calls, quote-unquote, model legislation for the rest of the country, which, again, in effect, would, you know, make any woman who is pregnant at any stage liable for a miscarriage.
You know, it's amazing. You know, when you think about the breadth of it, that even includes, and I know there had been some talk about, I guess they had said reckless behavior was what they had had in there earlier. And they, you know, but they still, even though they modified some of the language, that it still comes out to two things. One is you could, the breadth of it, I was stunned by even the fact that someone who's getting, has to make a choice now between getting treatment for cancer that might impact the fetus or staying with an abusive partner.
Well, I mean, this issue, again, you know, I think these things sound so fantastical that people can't grasp them. And then, it, you know, we get these dangerous laws because they sound so absurd and people don't grasp their meaning. What happened in Nicaragua, though, last week or last month, rather, I think it's really illustrative. Nicaragua has a law that bans abortion in all circumstances. There is a woman who is still in the hospital suffering from cancer who is being denied by the Nicaraguan government any cancer treatment because she's 10 weeks pregnant and they will not, you know, give her cancer treatment in case, quote unquote, it should harm the fetus. Never mind that without the cancer treatment, she won't live long enough to bear the pregnancy. And never mind that she has a 10-year-old daughter and a family. So these are the kinds of extremes, and it's not so far-fetched that this happened in the United States because that same month, a woman in Florida was ordered by a court to remain on bed rest and held by a hospital on court order, even though her fetus had severe fetal anomalies, because she was ordered onto bed rest and she wanted to leave the hospital and be at home. They would not let her leave. These are the kinds of things, the kinds of, you know, ways in which these laws creep into and affect all of us, which is why it is so important that we maintain women's rights to bodily integrity.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, this point of, you know, what you said earlier, I mean, first of all, it is criminalizing women, you know, as a gender. And it's actually this thing about reducing women to walking incubators is such an important, important point. And Jody, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Well, we'll have you back regularly, okay? Because I always enjoy talking with you. Okay, Jody, thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now. You know, this is the important point to leave this segment with, a couple of things. You know, abortion is not a moral issue, except the morality around abortion has to do with where do you stand in relation to the rights of women, in relation to the emancipation of women. You know, let's get clear on something. As Jody said, you know, let's get clear on a couple of points here. A fetus is not a child or a human being. Women are not incubators, and there should be, damn it, there should be abortion on demand and without apology. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Jody Jacobson from RHRealityCheck.org about the growing and dangerous assault on women by the anti-women, anti-abortionists. And that about wraps up this segment of the show. We're going to take a short break and be right back with an incredibly gripping, outrageous, and maddening story from Sharon Mosby, a black woman in Los Angeles whose 20-year-old son was murdered by the Los Angeles Police Department in January of 2008. So stay tuned. All right, you can't get any better than this. This music is going to, boy, I am like, I'm not going to go to sleep for a couple of days now. this is great. That was The Clash and Police on My Back from the Sandinista album. And right now, this is an extremely, extremely important story. I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing it except to say a couple of things. Back on October 22nd, 2009, I was down at the rally against police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation down in Leimert Park. I walked outside the rally and there was a sort of billboard showing pictures of people who've been murdered by the police over the years. And standing next to one of those billboards was a woman whose name was Sharon Mosby. I talked to her and asked her if she knew somebody on the board, and she said that her son had been killed by the LAPD. And that happened back in January of 2008. Sharon told me a story, and I was just a brief outline of it, and I was really moved by it, and I thought people need to hear this. It took a while to get the story together, you know, in terms of being able to think about it, being able to talk about it. When you hear her story, you'll understand. Being able to talk about the horror of what happened to her son and what happened to her. Sharon's son, Ronald Boone Jr., was a young guy who was generally quiet and calm. Sharon said he used to like to go fishing, work in the yard with her, and help her paint around the house. Ronald was getting ready to go back to school to get his GED and then move on to work as a contractor. All of this was stolen when the LAPD executed Ronald. And just a week ago, when one of the more outrageous moves in the case came up, Sharon decided that, in fact, now was the time to talk. So I met with her down in Crenshaw in her attorney's office right off of just below Leimert Park. And she told me her story, and she wanted to take that story to you. So without any further delay, let's listen to Sharon Mosby talk about her story and what happened to her son, Ronald Boone Jr. Why don't we start by you telling people your name and what happened to you? What happened to your son?
My name is Sharon Mosby. My son's name was Ronald Boone Jr. He was shot in the back of his thigh by LAPD. We were never notified of the shooting, which had occurred down the street from where we live. I went to the scene. That's how I found out he was shot. I asked the officer what happened. He said someone pulled a gun on a police officer and was shot in the leg. I asked him to describe the person that was shot, and he described the hair. So I asked him, what hospital did they take this person to that was shot? He said California Hospital. So I went home and I called the hospital. They kept saying that he wasn't there. My son wasn't there. So I called back and I said, this time connect me to the emergency room. I spoke to the nurse. She said, yes, we do have him. I called my family and his dad and we went to the hospital. When we got there, we were told that he was not there. And I said, you're lying because I just called and they said he was here. So they finally admitted that he was there, but the security guard that was assisting us said no one would talk to us, not the hospital, not LAPD. So we were standing next to the emergency room door and the door opened and we went in the back of the emergency room. We finally got to see, well, we didn't see him. I was standing in front of his door, his room, and I think they realized that we were back there and we were my son's parents. Someone closed the curtain around him. I remember standing there thinking, why they don't even want us to even look at him, to see him? This doctor came. I don't know where he came from. He told us to get out of his hospital. I said, well, we didn't mean any harm. We was just trying to make sure our son was okay. He said, matter of fact, get the f*** out of my hospital. So we left the hospital. We stood in front. About maybe an hour or two.
A doctor said to you, get the f*** out of my hospital?
Yes.
What were you thinking when he said that?
I'm pretty sure, knowing me, I said something back. I just can't remember what it was. But we left and we stood in front of the hospital, which is not that far from the emergency room. Maybe 30 minutes later, a doctor came and motioned us to come back in the hospital so that he could speak with us. And he said that they were doing exploratory and that my son may or may not need surgery. Okay, so maybe 2 hours more, and we were told that he was fine. It was nothing serious. The bullet broke his bone. You know, he told us to go home, get some rest, get something to eat, and we'll work on you guys getting in to see him, because I forgot, prior to that, I had begged, like I've never begged in my life, to see him. And we were told no. LAPD said we were not allowed to see him.
Now, at that time, when you went to the scene, did they say anything at all aside from, or did they produce anything? Like, you know, normally if they say that, well, somebody pulled a gun, did they would say, oh, yeah, and we have the gun, or there were evidence, or there was witnesses. Did they say anything at all like that to you?
No, they wouldn't acknowledge that it was even my son. even though it happened right down the street from where I live.
And so the only way that you knew it was your son was because of the description of the hair, and that was it? Was there anybody else around that might have told you that?
No.
So you got to the hospital, and you went through all this, and this is just a horror. When they said that they shot him, and they wouldn't let you see him, and they told you to go home, did you just then go home?
No. I went to the scene. And we tried to get the detectives, any police officer to speak to us, and they wouldn't. They refused.
What time of night was this?
When we went to the scene, at that time it was probably about maybe 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, something like that.
And then what happened when you went back to the scene and they wouldn't speak to you?
We went home. And I called the police station, 77th Division, to see if he was going to be arrested. What was he going to be arrested for, or to try to find out what happened? But I didn't get any information.
So then you went to sleep, you got up the next day, and what happened?
I got up the next morning about 5, 6, sick to my stomach. And I laid back down to about 8, I believe it was 8, like 8:24. And I got up, and his dad and I were talking about what time we were going to go see him, you know, or whether or not we was going to go to work. And I said, well, let me call the hospital and check on him. So when I called the hospital, the nurse said, I'm going to have his nurse call you back. So about almost an hour passed. It was a doctor that called, and he said that my son was in critical condition and we needed to get there. So when we got to the hospital, they took us in this room, and we sat there for quite a while. And it was a lady in there. I don't know who she was. And I asked her what was taking the doctor so long, and she kept telling me to be patient. Then I heard the door open, and I looked over my shoulder, and I could see a cross in black, and I realized it was a priest, and I knew then, and I just lost it. I knew, but I didn't understand why or how, and once I calmed down, that's when they told us he was no longer alive. And the priest was talking to me about God, and I asked the doctor what happened. And he said he didn't know.
The doctor didn't know what happened, why your son died?
No, he said maybe a blood clot to his heart. He wasn't sure.
And then what happened after that?
I had to tell my kids. I told my children. I went outside and I saw the doctor that had told me that night to get out the hospital. He was crossing the street. And I tried to catch up to him. When he got to his car, I finally made it to his car and I knocked on his window. Well, I tapped on his window. And I asked him, I said, how are you going to look at yourself in the mirror? And he said something, but I couldn't hear him because his windows was up. So he got out the car. And I asked him, how are you going to look at yourself in the mirror? And he said something to me. I said something back to him. He called me a bitch. And at that time, my husband and him had walked up, and they went to grab him, and this is what he wants us to do. We need to stay calm.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to an interview with Sharon Mosby, whose son, Ronald Boone Jr., was executed by the LAPD back in January of 2008.
We were going to go to City Hall to try to get, because after they told me my son had passed away, I asked to see him, because I hadn't seen him. I wasn't sure if it was even him. They told us no. LAPD said you're not allowed. And what do you mean I can't see my baby? Doctor said, LAPD said you're not allowed. So the priest asked me if I wanted him to go pray over my son's body. And I told him yes. And I asked the priest, I said, how is it okay for you to go pray over my son's body, but I can't see him? I don't remember what his answer was. Then we went home, and I called Yvonne Burke's office. I called Bernard Park's office. I even went to Bernard Park's office to try to get some assistance in seeing my son. We called the coroner's, I think my daughter called the coroner's office, and they said they would give us a picture, but I couldn't see his body. So he had the first autopsy on the 30th. And we had a second autopsy done. So I did not see his body until the 7th. He was shot January 28th. I saw his body February 7th.
Did they ever explain why you couldn't see his body or see him at all in the time from the time he was brought to the hospital until after these autopsies? Did they ever explain anything to you?
No, no one, including up until this day, has spoken to us and explained to us from A to Z what happened. Not a doctor, not LAPD, not the hospital, the coroner's office.
What did the autopsies show?
That he bled out.
Bled out, what does that mean?
That means that when he had the first autopsy, from the papers that I've read, the amount of blood that he had in his body is the same as the amount that when you get a blood test taken and they take that small tube of blood, he had less than that in his entire body.
Was there ever any explanation as to why that was?
No.
They just said he bled out and that caused him to die?
Yes.
No one ever said it was a result of the bullet wound or anything else, or they just didn't take care of him, or what?
No one has explained anything to us.
What happened after the autopsies?
I received a phone call from the second pathologist, and I was expecting him to give me results. He said he couldn't give me any results because my son's heart was not in his body.
Did he explain that at all?
How could he explain it? He didn't remove it. It wasn't there when he started performing the second autopsy.
What was going on?
I have no idea. I called the coroner's office and requested my son's heart. And we wasn't sure whether or not we was going to have his funeral because we didn't want to bury him without his heart. But we had already made the arrangements, so we decided to go ahead and have it. 2 weeks after the funeral, I believe it's 2 weeks, I'm not sure on the date, I received another phone call from the pathologist that did the second autopsy, and he still was requesting my son's heart. I called the coroner's office to ask him, where is my son's heart? I was told that they delivered it to the mortuary. I called the mortuary, and the mortuary said that when my son's body was on the way to the funeral, someone from the coroner's office said that someone from the mortuary need to come down and pick it up. She explained to me that she informed the coroner's office that she wasn't coming to pick it up. They needed to bring it because it should have been in his body in the first place. So 2 minutes before we walked into the funeral, this is what I was told afterwards, that a container was put in the casket with him. Is it his heart? I don't know. Is it anything in the container? I don't know.
Now, your son was murdered. What year was that?
2008.
And now 2 years down the line, do you know anything more?
No.
What has happened in that 2 years?
We have went to 2 mediations with the city and LAPD. One of the mediations, the first offer was $10,000. We refused that. The second time we went for mediation, the offer was my son's clothing that he had on the day he was shot.
I want you to say that again for people to understand that. The horror of this, the second offer was what?
My son's clothing that he was wearing the day he was shot.
They wouldn't let you see his body. You never saw him again after he left you that night to go out or whatever. You never saw his body again. You never saw any of this until he was buried. And then they turn around and they offer you the clothing that he was wearing when they killed him?
Yes. We were offered his clothing to sign a stipulation to dismiss the case.
This is such a horror. You get the clothing back from your child, from your son, that they murdered him in. If you would turn around and tell them it was okay, that they didn't really do anything anyway.
Basically, yes.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Sharon Mosby, whose son, Ronald Boone Jr., was executed by the LAPD back in January of 2008. And the story has continued in just one horrific move after another. A young man, a 20-year-old man, whose life was basically, as Sharon described him, as a calm, quiet young guy who liked to do things like work in the yard with his mom and paint around the house. He was going back to school to get his GED so he could then go off and become a contractor. Ronald's life was stolen from him like so many others are. He was executed by the LAPD and then dehumanized continually all the way up until now.
When we came from mediation, I called a friend of mine and asked her if she had another attorney. She gave me another attorney's phone number. He in turn looked at the case and told me the problems with it and not to dismiss this case. He said he could not take the case, but he referred me to another attorney that would take the case.
So you are fighting it now?
Yes.
What are the procedural steps here? One thing is, look, I think people should know this is just from beginning to end. This is clearly, you want to talk about a stolen life and then a total disregard. It's when they put money on the price on a young man's life, it's bad enough. But when they turn around and they tell you, it's like a slap in the face when they tell you they wouldn't let you see him. They wouldn't tell you anything about the circumstances of his death. They obviously haven't turned around and said, look, this is the proof we have that he was doing something wrong that deserved to be shot, even in their book.
They did say that he was doing something wrong.
What did they say?
They said that he was selling a gun to an undercover police officer. And he ran. And that's why he was shot in the back of his thigh.
So he was running away. He wasn't running towards them to attack them. He wasn't threatening them. He was running away from them?
I don't know. Because no one has spoken to us. So I don't know.
It's heavy. You don't know. And the point is that, you know, look, you shoot somebody. They always say, oh, he was coming at us. He was doing this. He was doing that. This is a person who's running in the opposite direction. It's not like, you know, if he's running at you to attack you, you can't shoot somebody in the back of the thigh. He's running away from them. And that was, they became the judge, the jury, the executioner on the spot.
I guess so. I went to the hospital on the 30th to get his medical records. When I read the medical records, I found out that at 12:30, I think it's 12:30, two police officers and two detectives escorted him from the emergency room to his room. They came in his room and they asked for blood and DNA with their own containers. He told them that they couldn't have it. They asked the nurse to take it anyway. She refused. She leaves out the room about, I believe it's an hour later. When she comes back in there, my son is on the floor with the officer standing over him. I believe it's maybe three to four hours later, the nurse came in there and found him non-responsive.
She found him what?
Non-responsive. He had passed away. In the medical records, when we got to the hospital, we were told he passed away, it was almost 12 o'clock in the afternoon. He was found non-responsive at 4:30 in the morning. In the medical records, LAPD told the hospital not to notify us that patient is deceased, that my son was dead. So we did not know that he had been dead for 6 hours and 10 minutes.
Did they ever explain why they said not to notify you?
No. No one honestly has explained anything. The things that I found out, bits and pieces from other people that I spoke to, as far as the LAPD speaking to me personally, explaining from A to Z what happened, no. The hospital, no. It was one phone call the day that we found out. And I don't remember what the officer was saying. I was begging him to let me see my son's body. I believe he spoke to his dad. This is the information we have.
So you're fighting it now. Is there anything you want to tell people who are going to hear this interview? Anything you want people to know about your son, about his death, about the LAPD, anything at all?
Don't be afraid of LAPD. If LAPD shoots someone you love, make sure you do a second autopsy. I want everyone to know. Period. If your religion is to be buried with your body parts, you better wonder how many people out there are buried and don't have all theirs. And where are they? LAPD, notorious. They talk about all the gangs. The illegal supposed to be gangs. They can call those gangs illegal if they want, but LAPD, they are legalized gangs. The harassment that they have done to me and my family since this has happened, unbelievable. Sitting across the street from my house every day for months, 6 months.
Tell me a little bit more about this harassment. They sit across the street from your house for just sitting there watching you? What else did they do?
the day that the story was in the paper, it was kind of cold that day. So I was going to drive my truck with my granddaughter to the store to get the newspaper because my brother had told me that it was in the newspaper. But when we walked up on the truck, it was a dead bird on my truck. I've been living there for 10 years. I've been parking in that same spot for 10 years. Never had a dead bird on my car or truck. The day we came home from the viewing, which is the first time I saw my son's body, they were sitting across the street with the park lights on for hours. This went on for months. One time I was standing in my driveway talking to a friend of mine. He was in his truck. I'm standing next to the truck. Police car pull up. They get out the car with their guns drawn. They walk towards me. But then when they got really close to me, they turned and went down the driveway of the church next to me. They came back out. They stood there with their guns drawn and they left.
You know, everything that you say in this story, it reeks of this, you know, just this blatant robbing you and your son, and by extension, black and brown people who live under the most horrendous conditions in the society, just denying, robbing people humanity. I mean, the kinds of things you describe are just so inhumane and inhuman, treating you like you're not a human being. To me, that's what's so damn outrageous about this.
All of it is outrageous, but the thing about it is I'm not the only one. It's a lot more people that go through this, but a lot of people won't fight. And that's the problem. If we all unite and stand up and stop them from these senseless killings, there's no reason for my son to be dead. Don't be afraid of him. Stand up.
Okay, Sharon, thank you. And please, you'll keep us posted on what happens as you fight this out.
I sure will.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Sharon Mosby talk about the cold-blooded execution of her son, her 20-year-old son, a guy who liked to work in the yard, paint with his mom, hang out, go fishing, was going back to get his GED. You know, a guy who wanted to become a contractor, 20 years old. Executed by the LAPD in January of 2008. And just to be clear, in the news accounts at the time, the LAPD said they believed that he seemed to be reaching for a gun. And that's why they shot him. That's why they executed him. For all those people that keep talking about this is a post-racial society, that things like what happened in San Diego, come on, can't you wake up? You see San Diego, come on, it's just a joke. It's just, we're just having fun. Don't be so serious. That oppression stuff is off the books. That don't happen anymore. They want to talk about ghetto life? This is what life is like for the vast majority of people that live in these neighborhoods that they're forced into. This is what it's like living under the gun of the modern day slave catchers that make up the police force, whose role is to terrorize people. This is what it's like. Each and every week, I talk to people and say at the end of the show and talk about the world cries out for revolution, for radical change, you know, and it's up to us. And I want to read something in going out today from the statement put out by the Revolutionary Communist Party, the revolution we need, the leadership we have. It is up to us to wake up, to shake off the ways they put on us, the ways they have us thinking so they can keep us down and trapped in the same old rat race, to rise up as conscious emancipators of humanity. The days when this system can just keep on doing what it does to people here and all over the world, when people are not inspired and organized to stand up against these outrages and to build up the strength to put an end to this madness, these days must be gone, and they can be. You want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslade@redfuture.com. I want to thank my engineer today, Melissa Figueroa, and Henry Carson and Age for their production assistance. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. As always, I do look forward to hearing from you. I look forward to hearing your comments, your ideas, your suggestions, your criticisms. I also want you to write to me if you have ideas about shows you think we should do, things you think we should cover, or if you have stories to tell yourself, things like what happened to Sharon Mosby, what you heard on the show today. Write to me. Let me know how to get hold of you. If you want to help with the show, do the same. Write to me and let me know how to get hold of you, and we can kick it around and work something out. So that's about it. I look forward to talking with you again next week. We're going to go out now with Wake Up from Anti-Flag. You know, it seems to be the most appropriate song. It's going to be a little bit jarring, but it's the most appropriate song I could think of, given the content of today's show. So kick it off with Wake Up from Anti-Flag.
That you're 5 minutes late.